As you realise, we're going to be looking at this very striking passage about the Tower of Babel this evening, and we're following this series in Genesis, chapters 1 to 15, which we've called In the Beginning. And tonight we have this chance to think about the meaning and the implications of this very important chapter in the history of man's origins. So, before we get into the text itself, and right back to the ancient world, let me introduce the subject by reference to the world we all live in today. We're dealing here in Genesis for the very first time with the activities of a whole society, not simply the action of individuals. So as a way into the issues that are raised, I'd like to make this one brief preliminary comment. And it's a comment concerning the way we respond as Christians to the issues in our own society. And then after that I'll tell you how I plan we should examine the text itself. The comment about our own world is this. It's really to ask us all a question. I'll put it very simply. Do you ever feel any sense of disquiet about the world we live in? I should imagine a great many of us would respond, of course we do. The world we live in today is becoming an increasingly unstable and indeed dangerous place to live. There are so many different levels, of course, where we feel this sense of disease. Vast issues face us, like nuclear weapons, famine, apartheid, issues facing the whole civilized world. And then the decline of our own society. Far greater social conflict, violence, crime, sexual offenses, immorality, instability than we've ever experienced before. Everything is speeding up. The progress of change and decline is accelerating at an enormous rate, and many ordinary, thoughtful people are responding to this. They are asking, where is it all leading? What is going to happen? Well, where is it all leading? We too should be asking that question, because we are the people of God. And if we are the people of God, our role is not to stand on the sidelines, not to stand on the sidelines and moralize or complain. We should be doing something about it. But, and it's a big but, before we can take any action, we have to be clear about what is precisely going on. We have to respond in terms of accurate analysis. Otherwise, our actions can, of course, go way off target. So, to clarify the issue, a further question to do with analysis. Does the Bible give us any clues on how to make sense of this increasingly mad world in which we are all living? And that approach is going to take us into the heart of the teaching in Genesis 11. I put the question that way because the issue is, in the end, a spiritual one. The degeneration of any society, of course, has its political, its social, its moral dimensions. But I think we're going to find that Genesis 11 demonstrates very convincingly indeed that the deepest malaise of any society lies in the severance of its spiritual roots, about which more in a moment. That is the introductory thought. I'd like you to keep it at the back of your minds, if you will, because we're going to come back to it later on. Now, the briefest word on how we'll proceed in examining the text itself. We basically need to look at three things: the setting, the action, and the response, because that's how the passage itself breaks down into those three parts. The setting in the flow of biblical history, the action itself and what is implied by it, then God's response, and what we learn about his judgment and his grace. Only a brief breakdown, but it's to help you know where we are going. All right? Let's look at the passage then and begin with verses 1 and 2. Verses 1 and 2, the heading, the setting in the flow of biblical history. It's very important background information. I'd like it if you could look down at it, please. I'll read it to you. Now, the whole earth had one language and few words. And as men migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. The setting of this narrative in the whole flow of biblical history. There are two distinctive elements which we should examine separately, and it revolves around two questions for clarification which we could put like this. Does this passage refer to an actual historical event? And why does it appear in our Bibles in the first place? The basic questions, but the answers to those questions determine everything else we're likely to say about the text. So, historicity first. Is this an historical event or something else? I think that we have to say on both strong linguistic and geographical evidence that we are dealing with an actual piece of history, something which took place in a definable setting at a particular time. We'll talk about archaeology later on, but a main clue in terms of linguistics and geography is found here in verse 2. We read there of a migration and settlement to the land of Shinar. Now I wonder whether you can see it. It's the name Shinar which is the clue itself. Perhaps needs a little bit of explanation. The fact that a specific locatable place is mentioned shows us that we are in the real, tangible, factual world of actual history, rather than the world of myth or parable, because that is how the Hebrew mind works. It's careful with its use of setting. You'll find that early Hebrew documents never suggest a locatable, geographical setting if real history isn't implied. Secondly, and this is rather fascinating, the use of the Hebrew name Shinar is itself illuminating. It shows a concern for historical accuracy. Shinar is the old name for Babylon, before Babylon became Babylon, if you see what I mean. Like Bright Elmstone was the old name for Brighton in the days when it was just a fishing village. Little context, you try and stay with me and I'll try to explain the details of this. Shinar is, in fact, a Hebrew transliteration. That means that it is a word which is made to sound like another word or name in a foreign language. Like the French say, le week-end, or le fish and chips. Believe it or not, those are transliterations. Now, it's been discovered that the actual ancient name for Babylon in the Hittite and the Syrian cuneiform texts is Shamhar. Hebrew transliteration, Shinar. The name in the original language, Shamhar. So can you see it? The Hebrew writer's concern there is for historical accuracy. He makes use of this name, Shinar. It's a transliteration. He makes up that transliteration. He goes to the trouble of representing in Hebrew the actual sound of the old Hittite and Syrian name for this area. The use of the name Shinar itself reflects a concern for accuracy as well as historicity. Don't worry if you didn't follow that entirely. I've got another little bit of evidence for you which is equally striking. It's in verse 3. Little historical detail, I wonder whether you picked it up when we read it. The use of brick for stone and bitumen for mortar, that's literally burnt clay and slime. That's a fascinating little bit of evidence too. Because we know that from archaeological remains, this represents the very earliest building practices of many thousands of years ago. There have been excavations in a place called Tello in this area, Tello, some of the earliest and most ancient Sumerian buildings. And those have revealed the use of baked brick and bitumen, just as described here. So again, these kinds of details suggest an accurate, historical, and carefully preserved and handed down account of something which belongs to the realm of actual happening, however long ago. Now, let's get this clear. We are dealing with something very early on indeed in the history of mankind. That it is long ago is clear from verse 1 itself. Now, the whole world had one language and few words. That equally needs a little comment. I'm afraid the RSV translation that Kim read so nicely from is not a very good translation at that particular point. The Hebrew actually says, literally, the whole world had one words. So you might translate that, the whole world had one set of words. The few words in the RSV, I think, is quite misleading. If you have a New International Version, which is God's version, it says... New International Version has, the whole world had one language and a common speech, which represents very accurately and helpfully the actual Hebrew text. Now this is the question that we need to ask ourselves. Is there any evidence outside the Bible that mankind ever had one common language? Well, the answer to that is no. At least it was no up until quite recently. In the last 15 years, the scientific evidence for one original common language for mankind has gained increasing and considerable support. Now, very big names are attached to this view. Noam Chomsky, who's the very distinguished professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he's lent his name to it. Others in the science of linguistics, such as Maurice Swadesh and George Miller, who's written a very important book called Language and Speech, they also have advanced considerable evidence. Maurice Swadesh is the most interesting one to my mind. He's the man who discovered some years ago that in languages whose history is known, 14% of terms for common concepts change their roots every 1,000 years. So, comparing languages spoken throughout the world, Swadesh reckons that all languages had a common ancestor as early as 10,000 years ago. George Miller is of the same opinion, though he puts it anywhere between 10 and 100,000 years ago. Nonetheless, there is clear scientific evidence, again, on the issue of a common language to confirm the historicity of this account. We'll come on to the actual Tower of Babel and the archaeological evidence for that a little later. But a word now on the place of this event in the Bible. Why was it included? And why does it come when it does? And again, of course, this is an important issue. By now I hope that we're clear about the historical nature of this account, but what about its theological dimensions? Of course, we'll learn more as we go through its details, but just a note for now on its position in Genesis itself. Two immensely important landmarks have been sketched so far in Genesis following the creation of man. One is the fall, and the other is the history of Noah, and then the flood, and the judgments which culminates in the making of the covenant of mercy, when God promises to replace his wrath with mercy, fallen and sinful though man is. So we see in the development, the theological development of this account in Genesis, from now on, God will be responding in mercy towards man. Everything that happens from now on in the Bible will be influenced by the existence of that covenant made with Noah, the covenant of mercy, is still in effect today. The process of salvation from this point in Genesis has begun. And that's what we have to keep in our minds as we approach this narrative. All then, these events that we're looking at on a plain in the land of Shinar come in the context of the covenant of mercy God made with Noah. Mercy is at work. And so in the account of the Tower of Babel, we have to have our eyes open to look for the activity of mercy at work, as well as the overall principle of God's action, as well as sin and judgment. Now, of course, there's another dimension to the outworking of sin, which we've noted already, according to the earliest part of the chapter, the spreading to the whole of society, which we've already begun to think of in our introduction. And we see this coming to its full expression as we move from the setting in the flow of biblical history to the action itself and what is implied by it. It's our second heading. The action itself, I think you'll find it's all there in verse 4 of Genesis 11. So let's have a look at that. Verse 4. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." That is an amazing landmark. This is the first public declaration of humanism in the history of mankind. The first declaration of humanism. Humanism is man going it alone. Humanism is man giving no reference to God. Humanism is man suspecting that he is sufficient to solve his own problems. And it's quite clear from this account in verse 4 that there's no reference here to God at all. It is a declaration of humanism. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. So let's establish what the tower is, and then we can talk about its significance. There is a great deal of archaeological evidence for absolutely huge towers known as ziggurats from the various earliest times in this area. And there are examples of something like 33 of them from 27 different ancient cities. And what is more, there are representations on jars and cylinders and bas-reliefs of ziggurats, which again have been discovered in archaeological excavations. You may know that the actual Tower of Babylon, or the Tower of Babel, was discovered at the beginning of the century in Babylon itself. It's at a place now named Ezzakin, and it was destroyed by Xerxes in 478 BC, and Alexander the Great had this site cleared, actually with the intention of rebuilding it, but he doesn't seem to have got round to it. So today, it's not much more than a quarry. But they've made some very interesting archaeological finds from that place, nonetheless. It appears that this tower was absolutely huge for its time. Details from historical sources like the Esagil Tablet and Herodotus suggest that the tower rose to a height of 300 feet above its courtyard, which was enormous for its day. Nebuchadnezzar II and Nabopolassar, to the Babylonian kings, gave it the name E-Temenenki, which means the house of the foundation of heaven and earth. And they made it into such a fabulous tower of pride that it was apparently one of the greatest and most remarkable wonders of the ancient world. But to me, it's absolutely fascinating that today, where once stood what was perhaps the most gigantic structure of the whole of the mighty Babylonian civilization, all that remains today is an enormous hole full of water. I leave you to draw your own conclusions. The action itself, the first declaration of humanism, man going it alone to make a name for himself, using every last ounce of his resources of technology and ingenuity to serve those ends, and confounded in the process by the reaction of God. So, we move on to the third section. God's response and what we learn about his judgment and his grace. You know, we sometimes need saving from ourselves. I don't know whether you've ever felt that. Most of us at some point are quite capable personally of following some course of action which ends up by hurting or harming us considerably. Sometimes we need someone else to step in and save us from ourselves. If that is true for individuals, it is certainly true for societies as a whole. And that's really what is happening here. Let's pick it up again in verse 6. Have a look down, if you could. Verse 6. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." They need saving from themselves. God sees right the way through it. He sees the implications. This is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Let's put that into theological context. First fact about God in the Bible, Genesis 1 verse 1, God is creator. First fact about man in the Bible, Genesis 1 26, man is made in the image of God. If man reflects in his own makeup the image of God the creator, then man is endowed with phenomenal creative potential. Do you realize that? But divorce that creative potential in man from its roots in God himself, then the scenario begins to look a bit more ominous. It's only the beginning. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. We've only to think of the primary use of nuclear technology today to see that point coming home. Man does need saving from himself. The unrestricted use of creative power, divorced from the will of God, has enormous potential for destruction. It was a very long time ago indeed that man discovered technology enables him to become like God. It is an illusion which persists right up to today. So, do you see the first public declaration of humanism is not only a cause for concern, it is a cause for action, a cause for action on behalf of God himself. What is the response of God to the situation? I want to suggest to you that overall it's a response of mercy, not of anger, and that there is something very profound we should therefore learn from the situation in our own world and our own society today. Remember again the positioning of this narrative. It comes after Noah, after God has promised never again to flood the earth. He has made his covenant of mercy. So when God confuses the languages of men, it is his discipline exercised upon an unruly race. It is the imposition of a natural restraint to protect man from himself by restricting his mutual understanding. The land of Shinar becomes known as Babel or Babylon. It's a play on words. Babel means in Hebrew, he confused. Confusion. Even today the word Babel means confused speech. It is the legacy of the first public declaration of humanism. The men who migrated from the east, who found a plain in the land of Shinar, who said, "Come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens." The setting, the action, the response. So now, as we close, we're in a much clearer position to ask, what actually does this text say to us today? I want to draw out very briefly four points of contact between the biblical world and our own world as we're faced with the issues of our society today. One, to do with humanism. Going it alone without God as an individual is bad enough. As a society, it is perilous. Take our use of technology. Entirely depending upon intention, technology today is taking us both into the world of blessing and of curse. We are a society, like the Babylonians, which is increasingly ignoring in every area of life the express will of God. It is perilous, and we do need saving from ourselves. That truth is foundational to do with humanism. Secondly, to do with God. God is not absent. He was not absent from the biblical situation. And God is not absent from our situation. The society may wish to shut God out completely from its activities and its dealings, yet there is never any real sense in which God is actually absent from our affairs. You can shut your heart and your mind to God, but because he is God, you cannot in fact succeed in shutting him out completely. There is no way that we can bar his activity from his own world. He cares too much about us for that to happen. But what about judgment? We have to be realistic. There will be a time when God will have to put his foot down and when he will say, "Thus far and no further." But it will be because of his mercy. He wants to save us, to prevent the worst from happening. Of course, then, that will involve judgment. At some point, the sheep must be sorted out from the goats, or else the world will stay forever in rebellion. To do with humanism, to do with God. 3, to do with history. We know from these earliest chapters in Genesis the origins of the destructive effects of the fall. We see this illustration of Babel. We see how it illustrates the fall, how the fall pervades the whole of society. Yet we know that God is working to overturn and reverse the effects of the fall. We know that. We know that because he sent his son, Jesus Christ. We know it primarily because of the cross. And we have a glimpse of the end to keep us on course. In the language of Genesis 11, God is poised. He is poised to come down one more time when Jesus will return to bring again, yes, God's judgment and also his mercy. And this time, it will be final. But it helps us to know what to expect. It helps us to know what to expect in a godless and a fallen world. A world which increasingly celebrates Swinburne's famous words, "Glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of all things." Well, he's not. And God is going to make that absolutely clear at the return of Jesus Christ. Humanism, God, history. So the fourth point is to do with our responsibility. We live in the light of the cross and the light of the second coming of Jesus Christ. And in the midst of a world spiritually not at all dissimilar to Babel, we look at our own society and we do ask questions. We ask questions like, where is it all leading? What is going to happen? Well, we've done our analysis. The root of the problem, it's the fallenness of man expressed collectively through society in terms of humanism. The deepest malaise of any society lies in the severance of its spiritual roots. So there's a consequence. Now, we cannot any longer stand on the sidelines. It's no use complaining. It's no use doing nothing. It's no use moralizing. We are the people of God, and we have to work on behalf of God and with God. So what does that mean? It means for all of us taking far, far more seriously the call to be Christ's disciples. Wherever we work, wherever we live, we have to be asking this question. What are the issues where I can be making a positive contribution for Jesus Christ? Sometimes that may mean taking on an opposing line. It may involve ethical issues at work. It could be to do with the quality of life in your area. It might be to do with various aspects of relationships, to do with your witness, to do with evangelism. Whatever it is, Jesus wants us to be salt and light to make an impact on society. Then as a church, as a community of Christians, we have got to learn to pull together. I mean it, I'm serious. You ask yourself, what can you do to input your talent and your ability and giving and prayer to serve Christ in this place? Do you care about the church? Christ did. He gave his life for the church. And many of you are pouring your love and your energies and your devotion into this place. But there are hundreds of you, honestly, who are not. I know there are some of you who are not in a position to do so, but the rest of you, don't you care about Christ, about the church, about the impact the church is meant to have on a dying world? This is a responsibility. It is not an option. You are not members of a club. You are part of God's salvation plan for the whole world to reverse the destructive powers of humanism. And we have to be clear about our priorities. I'm sad to say it, but there are far, far, far too many of you just interested in having a plain good time in this church. Every single one of us has got to play our part, whether it's a big part or a small part. Your part really matters, or else we're making nonsense of Christ's death for us. It's an ancient story, but it did happen, and it touches our world today. Its name was called Babel. There the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. They had said, "Come, let us build a city and a tower." Today, it is just a hole in the ground. What are you personally going to do? What are you going to do in our society and through the church? You, as a disciple of Jesus Christ, one of God's special, own, chosen people, to ensure that before very much longer, the same fate doesn't happen to us in our world today. I really hope you can see it. It's not an option. It's your responsibility. Let's pray together. I think that we should just remain silent for a few moments and think and pray about our commitment to serve Christ in this church and the outside world. I beg you not to evade the issue or any way in which God has spoken to you. And if there is something that you need to repent of, then take the time to do it now. So let's be quiet together. Amen.